To the Food Talk Show. Hi there, I'm Sue Nelson and this is the Food Talk Show. As ever, very excited to be in the studio and I'm joined by Guy Routledge, co-founder of The Food Rush. Hi Guy.
Hello Sue, how are you doing today?
Yes, good, hot again, it's always hot,
warm. A small box that we call the home a few times a week. It's always a little warm in here, isn't it?
It is a little bit warm, but it's okay because we're joined by Rob Wilson of Toast Ale, so we've got some ice cold beer to drink later.
Lovely refreshments. Seems like the perfect day and the perfect time for drinking beer, so I'm looking forward to that.
And me too. Before we go on to Rob, though, I'd like to welcome Jacob and Sam from Tiggs. Hi, I know you're on the phone at the end there. In front of me in the studio, which you can't see because you're at the end of the phone, I have four glasses which are very, very filled with very, very brightly coloured stuff, which I'm just about to taste. One's very green, one's very yellow, one's very, very red, and one's very orange. So I have, I believe, cool basil and pea, subtle pepper and mustard, a smoking tomato.
Smoking tomato.
It smells lovely. Mm. And the sweet original. And am I correct in thinking that you're inspired by these because of your love life? Have I got that right?
Because of my love life. Well, there is a bit of a taste.
The perfect match, you know, the perfect match, dating, you know, that sort of stuff. That's what I was reading on your website.
Yes, we've come up with this branding to go along in sort of a modern Lonely Hearts campaign. Sort of similarity and to try and sort of get young people to get involved with what can be regarded as a little more simple in terms of just sauces and dressings. And we thought we would come along and do something which is a bit more modern and similar to Tinder or some other apps like that where you sort of find your perfect match for your food.
Yeah, all of our products are really versatile. That's one of the key things about them. And a way we thought of communicating that was you could try and date each dressing or sauce with different types of food. And to see which might become the perfect match, because you can use them as salad dressing, you can use them as pour-on sauces, marinades, relishes. And so it's up to the consumer to sort of date each sauce, find their perfect match for each bottle individually, but also finding each bottle's perfect match for them on different types of dishes. There's two different ways of trying to communicate how versatile they are and have a bit of fun with it.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I haven't been on Tinder, but Guy, I presume you have you?
No, I haven't actually. I've heard of it though.
Oh, yeah.
I hear it's a very popular tool.
Yes, I hear it's a very popular tool. So we're going to taste these in the studio. We're joined by Rob Wilson of Toast Ale, who we're going to talk to later on. Essentially, it is a question of taking these sauces, which got lovely packaging, and some of them got a great taste award, which is great, and literally experimenting and seeing, you know, what you can do with them, I guess.
It is a really interesting idea as well, having a product which is versatile. I think a lot of people these days, they tend to go for something that's got a very specific or very niche use case. But the idea of putting these things in a bottle and saying you can kind of do anything you like with it is quite an interesting idea, really.
Well, they're all based, I don't know if you know, they're all based on recipes of our grandmother, Granny Tigg, which is where the brand name Tiggs came from. We named the brand after her. And so we've grown up eating them all our lives from being knee-high to a grasshopper up to where we are now. And we've experimented using them on different things, such as being at university when we weren't great chefs. We would pour on some Tiggs on different things and go, hang on, that works quite well. So initially, they were used mainly as salad dressings. It's just from our own use that we've realised they can go on lots and lots of different things.
Well, we've just tasted the sweet original, perfect match Tiggs.
Good taste to start. That's our favourite.
That's our personal favourite.
It's got a nice sort of, vinegary tang.
Yeah, vinegary, just like a salad dressing or like a vinaigrette or something like that. It's got that kind of nice, you know, sharpness to it, but not in a way that is off-putting. It's really well balanced, actually.
Lemon juice there. Rob, what do you think? You've just had a quick taste.
Yeah, absolutely delicious. I'm looking forward to putting it on something rather than just
Not
having a spoonful.
Yeah, exactly.
On something. Okay, well, we're going to try the basil and pea. Tell us about... So I presume the original was actually from your grandma and then you started branching out.
Yes, so the original is what really inspired us. And we, having grown up on it, thought that this is too good not to share with the world. It'd be wrong of us. And with its sort of versatility of like Jacob was saying, of different ways that we've used it, we thought, well, let's get this out into the world. And so we started off just with that original recipe. And as time went on and we began to speak to our customers and get in front of lots of people at lots of shows, we thought, well, we'd better get some of Granny's other recipes out and so we can get a bit of a range going.
Well, we've just tasted the, I've just tasted the basil and pea. Now, I can imagine putting that in all sorts, actually, pasta.
Yeah, it tastes just like a pesto, so it'd be great mixed into some pasta.
Mm. What you're getting there is, like you say, it's similar to a pesto, but you've got no nuts, no dairy with it. So it opens it up to a lot more people for free from. It's a lot lighter, a lot fresher, and the bonus of being a bit healthier as well.
And now I've just tasted the subtle pepper and mustard. Now, I love mustard. I really
I really love a good whole grain mustard.
And that is whole grain.
It is. Yeah, you can even see the bits in it as well. And they have got a bit of texture to them, these things. They're not like a super smooth sauce, even though you would say that it is, you know, smooth rather than lumpy. But it's, they've got a really nice kind of feel to them.
Mm. And now I'm just tasting the smoking tomato. That's got a little bit of a kick, hasn't it?
I had a cheeky sniff of that one earlier before we started, and it smells fantastic.
Well, I'm just getting chilly now, quite a bit.
Mm. So the story behind the smoking tomato, this is our brand new product, or as of the last couple of months. This is Sam and I's first attempt at making one. So the other four, we also have a beetroot, but unfortunately sold out of at the BBC Good Food Show over the weekend. But this is our first attempt. The other four are all based on Granny's recipes. And after doing a few food festivals and shows, people were asking us for a bit of heat. And we wanted to do something with a bit of a smoky flavour, so we thought we'd combine the two in a really even more healthy fashion than the fact that there are only 19 calories a serving that
way. Can I just say that's absolutely making Guy cough?
I think it's just gone down the wrong way.
I think it's because it's a bit spicy.
Kind of die in the corner, but yeah, it's really, really nice. I like a bit of heat as well. I'm definitely on board with the views of all your other customers. That's cracking.
Mm. And I think the trick here is trying to work out combinations of things. And I was talking to Guy before the show about a book called The Flavor Thesaurus.
Yeah, it sounds brilliant.
Pronounced that correctly for a change.
Are you going to give me your copy so I can have a flick through?
No, you can't. You have to buy it yourself.
Buy it myself. Fine.
So The Flavor Thesaurus is by Nikki Segnet, and it's a great book. And it's literally a wheel where it's got all these different flavours, and then it matches things. So for example, the pages on mustard will tell you all the different things that go really, really well with mustard, and some of those things you would never think of.
So is it a bit like a colour wheel where have things that kind of go blend well together, but then there's also maybe some opposite things as well? Has it got that kind of thing in it?
Yeah, and as I say, there's things that you wouldn't think of, and quite a lot of it herbs, some spices, but some other ingredients. And I think that's what you're doing here, isn't it? Trying to play around with what goes together, what matches each other.
Yes, exactly. And what Granny always used to say is she always thought, because Granny originated from New Zealand and always thought that dressings were rather boring, in her words. And so she wanted to create something that whizzed up everything and went on the salad and could accompany the meats as well. And she really enjoyed all her cooking in different flavours and fresh produce. And so by her genius in the kitchen has come up with these different sort of pairings, I suppose.
That's the good thing about them as well. They are unique flavors. We're not reinventing the wheel, such as a new honey and mustard or a Caesar dressing or a balsamic vinegar dressing. These are completely individual in their own right.
And how did you come up with those flavor combinations? Was it a shot in the dark, or is it, you know, purely based on the old recipes? How are you going to be coming up with new ones? Is there some kind of science or research behind it?
Well, up to now, we've been immensely lucky with the combinations that Granny came up with, because we've stuck almost identically to her recipes. Thinking we might have to change things, for example, to get a shelf life. Yeah. But actually, Granny bases everything on apple cider vinegar, which was a bit of a bonus for us, because it's not only very good for you, it's also a great natural preservative, and it balances everything out quite nicely in the bottle. So they all keep really well, and they've got that sort of added health benefit too. So we've been able to stick to Granny's recipes, and from those, we've learned a lot as well. So by getting out and talking to people, we can sort of learn what sort of fashions are out there, what people are interested in at the moment. For example, beetroot was quite popular and still is at the moment. And something like that might pop up, and we could try and experiment with something new up and coming in the future.
And what is Granny's name?
Gran's name is, or maiden name was Anne Webb. She's now known as Anne Hen, because our grandpa's Alan Hen.
So good,
like the chicken, yeah.
Yeah, good old Anne. Good old Anne. Thank goodness for that. I bet you're pretty pleased that she's your grandma.
We are. And it's quite fun as well. I don't know if you know this, but when Granny was a young girl, and this is one of the reasons she was able to go from New Zealand to England to emigrate, was that she actually won Miss New Zealand in 1948 in a woolen bathing suit she knitted herself, which is quite fun. And it was from that that she had the means, so to speak, of being able to come to England on a 6-week boat trip by herself with no family, no friends, made that trip and then ended up finding our grandpa and seducing him, obviously, with her sauces and dressings.
That's amazing. And there's a wonderful picture of Granny Tiggs on the website with you guys kissing either side of her, which is quite fun.
She looks an amazing lady.
Really. We have a few people who go, oh, yeah, you just made all this up. There's no such thing as Granny Tig, or she was never Miss New Zealand. And she's real. You know, we see her all the time. She's a staple, was always the staple of our diet, or the recipes she would come up with. Mm.
And she's incredibly modest, too, because she doesn't quite realise now how many people have tasted her dressings. Because when we sort of decided to start this up and said to Granny, please teach us how to make these, she said, nobody's going to want to try them. They're just my boring old flavours. And we said, how wrong you are. We're going to get these out into the world. Everyone should have a taste.
And is she going to inherit the fortunes, or are you going to cut her out of it?
Good question.
Yeah. Lots of hugs and kisses.
Well, when we start to make a fortune, we'd be only too happy to share it out. Yeah.
So at the moment, you're in Ocado and you're at Whole Foods Market. How are you finding it? Because it's actually quite a crowded category, quite a difficult thing to stand out.
Immensely crowded category. I think if we knew what we know now before, we may have thought, hang on, what are we doing? We're a bit mad. But we just jumped in head first and thought, you know, we'll give it a go. Get this out. There's nothing like it, the original. And from there, it's just, we sort of learned different ways of doing it. We made a few mistakes as we've gone along. But we firmly believe that we offer something a little bit different in a very crowded category, in the fact that they're really healthy, they're really versatile, they're unique recipes, and they're just something a little bit different.
Mm. But we do love a salad in this country, so it's a category that's growing in terms of the popularity, and this is the perfect time of year for it as
well. Especially at the moment. Rob, you've obviously got Toast Ale and you've founded Toast Ale, and you could argue that the beer category is incredibly crowded as well. Have you got any sort of top tips for these guys here?
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about the right pairing, actually, as to which sauce we should be pairing with which one of our beers. We've got a similar colour scheme going on, actually, yeah, for some of our labelling. I wouldn't be so, so presumptuous or bold to offer too much advice. We're an incredibly young business ourselves, just 18 months in. We're lucky enough to also be stocked at Whole Foods. We've just got ourselves into Waitrose, and I think some of the logistical challenges of growing is one key thing to be super aware of as business starts to grow and as the range starts to diversify as well.
I mean, obviously, we're going to talk to you later about the story behind your brand, but actually, people want to hear the story, don't they? And having Granny Tiggs is you know, it's real, it's authentic, but actually, people quite like that.
Absolutely, I'm sort of envious that there's no Granny Tiggs behind Toast Ale. And keep thinking how lucky Grandpa Tiggs is.
Yeah, indeed, and also packaging labelling is incredibly important, because you've got, no matter what the story is, you have to stand out on the shelf.
Exactly, I think the thing people say is there's a sort of a split second decision that a consumer will make. It's an incredibly crowded market, whether we're talking sauces or beers. I think beers even more so. You're looking at a craft beer shelf these days with 50 fantastic craft beers, and not a lot necessarily to choose between them. There's brilliant tasting beers out there now on the market, and so how you're going to capture the attention of a consumer is incredibly important.
Mm. And I think that's what I'm seeing with your packaging, guys. It's just straightforward. It says what it does on the tin, so to speak. And the actual natural colours of the product are really helpful.
Yeah, they really shine
through.
Because
they stand out. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, actually, where would you find it in the supermarket? Because it is such a versatile product. Is it in the sauces area, or is it with dressings, or do they all go together? I have to say, I haven't been to a supermarket for a long time.
It is an interesting question, that one, because actually I've never wanted to pigeon ourselves as solely dressings. And the same really of just being solely sauces. So we don't want to get lumbered, muddled up with the ketchups and the brown sauces. And we don't want to be just sort of sat next to the honey and mustards as well. So it's sort of, if we could get a new shelf going in the middle, that'd be ideal.
Yeah, but those things are always tough though, aren't they? To try and break out of the categories that the buyers like to put people into. It's tough when it is so versatile, because you wouldn't want to take away that versatility almost, because it means that people can do more things with them.
I think where we've got a real opportunity is because of that natural colour. We can sit on the dressing aisle and sort of really lighten it up, as you can see in front of you. Sort of, it does wake up that shelf space. And I think that from there, just by getting out there and talking to lots of people and advertising social media and everything, we can just try and get a bit of a buzz going around them.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed. you can go onto the website tigitup.co.uk, so that's T-I-G-G-I-T-U-P, tigitup.co.uk, to find out a bit more. And as we said before, we can get it on Ocado, can't we?
Of course, yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us, guys. I'm going to tuck in a little bit more to the pepper and mustard. That's my favourite. Yours, Guy?
I really like the pesto-y one, the basil and pea, I believe. Basil, it's really fresh. I think it's perfect for summer.
Perfect for summer. Thank you very much for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
No trouble. Cheers, at all. Guys. It is difficult, isn't it, Rob, in terms of launching a new... you know, a new brand now. There are just, I mean, we often say on this programme, don't we, Guy, that it's the new rock and roll, and so many people want to take some sort of family thing or some story and try and bottle it all up or package it all up and get it into Ocado or Whole Food Markets. It's incredibly competitive.
It is incredibly competitive, and also the risk of just becoming a flash in the pan and maybe managing to break into a market, but then quickly being delisted and forgotten. It's rather ruthless, a marketplace as well.
So how does the delisting thing happen? You know, you manage to get yourself at the moment in Waitrose. Do they sort of review it every month or something, or do they look at your sales? How do the buyers assess whether you're a success?
Yeah, so thankfully, and not just saying it, but thankfully it's not yet been an experience that we've directly had to face. Thankfully, no one's delisted us yet. What we're warned about when dealing with the likes of Waitrose is that after launch, approximately 12 weeks after launch, they would look to review how things are going. They set a minimum expectation of how many bottles would be sold per store per week. We're given a daily update as to how that is progressing. And basically at that 12-week mark, we would sit down and review where things are at based on their expectations and ours. And at that point, they could choose to make a change.
But what sort of numbers are we talking about? You know, if you had a normal size Waitrose store, how many are they expecting you to sell in a week or a day?
Yeah, so typically, actually, in a normal Waitrose store, they would expect to sell just one bottle a day.
Really?
And so that's the sort of average that they'd be looking at around
one bottle a day.
Yeah. So it's around sort of
I'll go and sort you out for a week.
Yeah, thanks. so it's only sort of seven or eight or so per store per week. Most supermarkets will work on that sort of basis.
But I guess when
in the craft beer category now,
right?
When you're stocked in many, many, many stores, that's actually a reasonably large volume of sales overall, though, isn't it?
It is. Yes. Yeah. So we sell sort of around 1,500 beers or so every week through Waitrose.
Fantastic.
Blimey, so they must be happy with you at the moment.
Well, yeah, and vice versa. And so it's a fantastic, game-changing sort of part of our business, actually, to suddenly be dealing with that kind of volume.
And what do the supermarkets do in terms of logistics? So say you are selling, I don't know, let's say 12 a week, which has its downsides because you've got to get that distribution there. How much do they stock in store, or do they just expect you to replenish all the time?
Yeah, so most of the supermarkets now, and we've spoken to many of them, Waitrose is the one that we're dealing with directly right now, but have had great conversations with all, and they're very encouraging, actually, of working with smaller suppliers. They'll be very supportive. They'll help get you set up, talk you through the expectations of distribution. We just have to deliver into one depot. We'll have about 2 weeks' notice to deliver an additional pallet, and typically they'll order one pallet at a time, Yeah, that's sort of how you sort of then
and
sell through.
How many bottles is a pallet for your normal?
Yeah, so at the moment it's 1,500 basically bottles on a pallet,
yeah.
And so they were about 6 weeks into the arrangement with Waitrose. They took sort of a bulk to begin with, so they'll take sort of four or five pallets to start with, and then they'll sort of start selling those through. And so we're basically at a stage where it will probably be about a pallet a week, and great for us to be managing.
Yeah.
And yeah,
I mean that's really the reason why getting into sort of ambient category is so useful, isn't it? And ambient being the fact that it doesn't go off very quickly. When you're delivering, you know, yogurt or something, that then your logistics are really quite difficult.
That's more challenging.
Or ice cream, or you know, something like that.
Oh yeah, definitely. The sort of stress I'd imagine that must be involved in those logistics is extreme. I mean, for us, the fresher the beer, the better, and certainly all of our customers and stockists are super eager to drink that beer as soon as it's been brewed.
I'm super eager to drink this beer.
Well,
as soon
we
as
should
it's brewed,
be.
Actually,
we should be. Let's crack it open. And so, you know, the shelf life is 12 months. In reality, we're all about fighting food waste. We're actually thoroughly against use-by dates in general. Yeah. On the bottle, we make it perfectly clear that there might be a best before date, but it's still perfectly drinkable after 12 months. There is no arbitrary cutoff
if it lasts that long
at the 12-month mark, and it very rarely lasts that long anyway. Yeah,
absolutely.
Good. Well, we're going to take a short break now, and obviously we'll be back in a tick to talk to you about Toastdale and the whole story. And we're very interested in food rescue, aren't we, guys? So
absolutely, yeah. It's a hugely important topic. It's something that we've written a lot about on the Food Rush as well. And it's just great to continue that conversation. And
So we'll have a break and talk about that in a minute. Meanwhile, we're going to go to a little pre-record we did with Charlie Jones.
So here we are at the show, and congratulations. I'm joined by Charlie Jones. Charlie Jones is from Kitchup, and you won an award yesterday, Charlie. Tell us about it.
We did. We were, we got a silver award for the Food Talk Show, which was fantastic. We had the dinner last night, and we were pleased to be there.
It was amazing, actually, and it's great to see Kitchup recognised. Tell us a little bit about what Kitchup is about and what technology you've built.
Yeah, so basically we're the UK's first online marketplace for commercial kitchens. So what we do is take vacant and sort of underused kitchen spaces and we list them on our website so that sort of a range of exciting food businesses can rent that space.
Because to set up your own kitchen and comply with all the regulations can be very, very expensive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we found when we launched the website that it was particularly startups that we were trying to help. Finding a commercial premises is hard to find. Very expensive, as you say, with the initial setup cost of the equipment. Long leases, you know, there's lots of barriers to entry there for startups. And then obviously you grow out of your home kitchen, so you need to kind of bridge that stage between getting your own commercial premises and growing out of your home kitchen. And that's where it all kind of started for us.
Because the food market in the UK and the food production market is, well, not short of awesome, really. There's so many different types of food and different types of technology going into it. Yeah. It can be really hard when you set up, can't it?
Yeah, no, it can be. I mean, the production space is really exciting. We found that, you know, when we started out, we were helping people with production. But with our kind of website, we found that people were coming in and sort of saying, actually, we want to use your kitchens for filming. We want to use it for a photo shoot. We want to do development work. So, you know, we're doing hires across the board from production, development, media, events. Supper Club is a big kind of area that's growing. So, we've kind of hit all the different kind of bases on the food businesses.
How geographically widespread are the kitchens that can be hired, and what's the sort of lead time from a company going onto your website and actually being able to set up?
Yeah, so we have 60 kitchens listed across London now. So we kind of focus in the areas or the foodie hotspots of London. Everyone wants to be in kind of like East London or South London in terms of where they want their kitchens. There's a big hub up in Park Royal. There's lots of kitchens up there, but people are kind of naturally moving away from that now and looking to go as central as they can, basically. And then in terms of when people kind of set up, there's no real typical journey, because you could have a corporate organization setting up a central production unit, which may take a month to do, and they may want to go in and set up the kitchen to be more specific for their needs. You could have a baking business go in, inquire on the website, and the next day they're in there renting a kitchen because everything's there ready to go for them.
So what was it the fact that you were renting out your own facility that prompted you to develop this capability?
So it was actually, I was working for the government startup loan scheme, so a company called Startup Direct, who are one of the sort of founding delivery partners. And it was with those guys that I was on the sort of mentoring team, sort of matching businesses with mentors. And their number one problem, the guys that came for funding, was finding kitchen space. So we funded lots of food businesses. And all of them were sort of like, where do I find a kitchen? What do I do? And it was just through helping a few individuals there look for space that, the search was very fragmented. There was, there wasn't much space available. You look on Gumtree and you find a few kind of unsupported listings as such. So it was from that that we kind of developed the idea. And I just sent out a few questionnaires to kind of, judge the market on whether people would rent their kitchens out.
And what about the user interface? Is it like a bit of an Airbnb? People just go on, search the location, the size of the kitchen they're after. There are quite a lot of selection options for them.
Exactly. So at the moment we've built, I suppose, it is an MVP. It is a model where you can search and, you know, there's a keyword search where you can put in, if you're looking for a rationale, it will bring up all the kitchens we've got with rationales in. We do it on location based as well, so we separate out into different areas. And at the moment, you do just interact with regards to, you send an inquiry into us and we deal with the inquiry first because of the fact that we want to kind of work with the businesses, find out a bit about them. It will never be as simple as booking a room on Airbnb because sometimes, regardless of whether you're a startup or a corporate, it's a big business decision, renting a kitchen space. So people normally want to have a chat with someone and be sort of led through the process. But I think now what we're doing is we're looking for our funding to kind of build a much more sophisticated platform that can automate a lot of what we do.
And so what's been the hardest part of setting up the capability on your website?
Setting up the website? I think finding someone to do it in the first place was quite tough for an affordable rate. I'm not a technical sort of person. I'm coming from a food background predominantly. So not having the technical expertise was a real struggle at the start. And bridging that gap of like not having a tech co-founder, but needing someone to build something for you for cheap that does, you know, a lot was a struggle. And then working with that, you know, company kind of to build your platform was a very big learning experience. I think if I do it again, you know, the amount of detail I would go into on a web brief would be, I would just make sure that is 100% as I need it before I go in. You know, I was very much kind of like rushing to get going at that stage, wanting to get something out there, which is, I think, is good, and it's important to get a product out there to market. But, you know, I think if I did it again, I'd definitely spend more time sort of working through the brief to make sure there's no areas of concern.
So you're joining users with suppliers, effectively. Yep. What's been harder, finding new users or people with kitchens to rent?
So for us, the supply side's the struggle. The demand's there. Yep. We've got lots of people needing kitchens, right through the spectrum from startup through to corporate. For us, you know, hosts are out there. There are 18,000 accredited food premises in 5-star rated premises in London. So they are out there. It's just getting to those guys.
Yeah. Well, James likes to eat constantly during the day. So if you've got any spare capacity just for a quick sandwich or anything, isn't that right, James?
Yeah, where's the closest one? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because we're really hungry. Sounds fantastic. Where can people get more information?
So www.kitchup.co.uk. You can follow us on our social channels. So we're Kitchup UK on Twitter and Instagram. So yeah, come and check us out. There's some exciting things to come.
And you must see all the emerging trends in food as they come in, because you're getting lots of new companies. What's really interested you recently that you've seen?
We do see so many different people trying to do different things. I think the fermentation thing's quite big, people doing like pickles, you know, the kombucha trend's still there and people are still setting up lots of, you know, fermented tea businesses. Vegan's still growing. We get lots of people, you know, wanting to produce vegan burgers and do vegan street food and things like that. So I'd say that's probably something that we see quite a lot of.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, Charlie, and congratulations on your award. Real achievement. Cheers.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we're back here with Rob Wilson of Toast Ale, and it was very good to speak to Jacob and Sam of Tiggs. Let's just talk beer now, though. Shall we taste first? Or?
I think we should. It's always a good conversation starter,
first.
Isn't it?
So
loosen things up,
Rob, we've got three beers in front of us. We'll explain in a minute about how you make this beer, because it's an incredible story, and we're great fans of Toast Ale. So which one are you suggesting that I taste first?
Let's start with our pale ale, actually. This is our flagship that we launched with. And so let's crack into
opening
crack
that into now.
That. Oh, it's a good noise, isn't it?
It is a good noise. So that's just, what sort of percentage proof is that?
So this is 5%.
5%, good. That's nice, good, clean fun. it's beautiful, beautiful a very honey-ish colour, isn't it?
Mm. It is, yeah. And I mean, I'll sort of see what sort of tasting notes that you maybe pick up.
But, well, obviously, guys are complete.
I have to say, I'm a bit of a fan of toast. And it just so happens that wherever I go to an event these days, and I do go to all sorts of random different foodie startup-y kind of things, Toast Ale it always seems to be there because everyone wants to help out the industry and, you know, support the new brands, the new producers and all sorts of stuff like that. So I've had probably too many of these in my lifetime, although maybe you disagree, Rob.
Exactly. They never have too many.
Yeah, I like that. It's got a nice sort of hoppy... Mm.
It is a fantastic...
Proper... Yeah, I've got loads of...
I don't know enough about beer to do it justice in the explanation, but it's also a little bit sweet, and I guess that's part of the toast that's actually in the bread.
Yeah, so
in the beer, sorry.
Yeah, so what we're... what we really pick up is some sort of caramel notes there.
Yeah.
Some sweetness coming through, very hoppy. It's got some nice bitterness.
Very hoppy.
See, I'm glad we bought Rob. He knows what he's talking about.
That's good, isn't it? Well, he should do. He owns the company. So we're going to taste the other two in a minute. Explain why it's called toast for anybody that doesn't know already. And I know nearly half the bread that people buy gets thrown away, which is a disgrace, isn't it, really? But especially in this weather, it's really hard to keep bread in good condition. And you can't buy... 4 slices of bread, you have to buy a loaf in this country. So please explain the story behind it.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so one thing to sort of clarify. So I'm chief toaster. I can't claim to be the original founder behind Toast. I've been involved since the beginning, but Tristram Stewart, who very much is the founder, is a pioneer against the sort of fight against food waste. Tristram's a best-selling author and campaigner. And has done more than arguably anyone to really sort of raise awareness about food waste. He and I had become good friends because I was running an organization that supported social entrepreneurs. He and I were chatting about 18 months ago when he'd just come back from Brussels. He'd tried a beer called Babylon that was brewed with bread, called Babylon because the first ever beer recipe that's been discovered had bread as an ingredient from 4,000 years ago. So for millennia, we've brewed with bread. Bread is something that goes stale very quickly, and humanity has realized that there's something very sensible you can do with that. You can ferment it down and turn it into beer.
So you take bread and you actually do toast it, don't you? That's why it's called toast.
When we first started, we were toasting. So we don't actually toast it right now. So when we first started, we were toasting the bread. We felt like that helped some of the sugars to come out of it. Mm. So what we're actually doing with the bread is we're replacing about a third of the grain that you would otherwise put into a beer. So the beer making process, in a nutshell, you have something called a mash tun, but just imagine a big saucepan. You put hot water and grain into that saucepan. All of the sugars come out of the grain and create a sugary liquid. We replace a third of that grain with bread, and all of the sugars come out of the bread.
Literally
in the same way.
Literally just sliced bread.
Yeah, sliced bread that we actually crumb it up. Yeah, so we turn it into breadcrumbs. So when we first started, we were toasting it. We then put whole loaves in. We've put slices in. We've crumbed it. We've done every single variant. And at the moment, we feel like we've got the most sort of efficient setup. Obviously, toasting was quite energy intensive, quite time intensive as well, and so it wasn't sustainable.
So, how have you kept that kind of toasted flavour in here? Because you've mentioned earlier, like that caramelly kind of note to it. So, is there anything special that you've had to add to kind of maintain that?
Yeah, so nothing necessarily that you would artificially add as such. One of the malts that goes into the beer is something called caramalt, and caramalt, you can tell by the name, is so cool because it has quite a caramelly flavour, and so we upped the amount of caramalt that we're putting in into the brew, which helps some of those caramel flavours still really come through. So it's you know, what we say at Toast is we're on a mission to prove that the alternative to food waste is pint-sized and delicious.
Very good piece of marketing.
And,
yes.
And if we if we can inform and educate an audience about the fact that 44% of the bread that we bake goes in the bin, a third of the food that we produce is wasted. It's 1 million tons of bread that's wasted in the UK every year.
It's crazy, isn't it?
And there's a perfectly sensible solution. The beer industry is a big industry, and if some other companies were to realize that they could replace their grain bill or a percentage of it with perfectly good fresh bread, that would otherwise go to waste. We could really tackle this problem.
And they can, because you've kind of taken this recipe and open sourced it. It's available on your website. You can go and, you know, download it and brew your own toast.
We have. So we, obviously, we're somewhat biased, but we think it's a truly scalable solution. Mm. So we've open sourced the recipe so that people can homebrew at a local level. They can go into their local bakery. They can find the bread that a baker, so a baker will, you know, produce enough bread so that they can sell at 5 to 5 just before they shut up shop. But at 5 o'clock, all of that bread is going to have to go in the bin because the next morning they want to sell fresh bread again. But it's still perfectly good bread for at least the next 48 hours. You can go and get that bread, brew it up to our recipe and start tackling bread waste at home. We've brewed with breweries all over the country where we've collaborated, and collaboration brews are becoming more and more popular in general. And so we've done some great collabs. We produced a bread pudding with a brewery in Bristol called Wiper and True. Fantastic beer that we made, a milk stout, a lovely beer. We're doing that more and more to start tackling bread waste at a regional level. And we're also growing globally to start tackling bread waste globally.
So it says here on my research that you've saved at least 5,000 kilos of bread and you've brewed over 56,000 litres of beer. I would imagine those figures are... You've surpassed those figures easily by now. Mm. But the whole ethos of the company is actually not to make a profit, but to be a social enterprise. So that when you spread this message and you try and get people to really think about their food waste, you then actually put all the money that you're making in the company back into food waste campaigning, which is... so laudable. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it's with the charity Feedback, isn't it?
That's right.
Was also founded by Tristram Stewart.
Exactly. So when Tristram and I were speaking 18 months ago, what he was trying to do was come up with an idea that really tackled food waste at multiple levels, as well as creating a sustainable income stream for... here you go. So you have a bottle opener. She's cracking into the next beer straight away.
I'm not listening.
She said so much that she'll take the top off first before she tried to pour it.
No holding about that. That 5% beer is obviously
it's gone straight to our heads.
Really trying to tackle food waste at multiple levels. What we say when we describe Toast is really it's a 4-part mission. And what I really try to emphasize first and foremost, it's just a great quality product. Yeah. And so you might be able to sell a beer or sell a product on the basis of a great story that we've already spoken about earlier in the show. But unless it's a great product, people aren't going to come back and buy it again. So first and foremost, it's a great product.
Well, it's just a given. It has to be.
Exactly. Secondly, we're tackling bread waste head on. Thirdly, we're communicating about food waste. And then that fourth super important thing for us is pouring 100% of our profits into the food waste charity Feedback, which is trying to tackle food waste at a systemic level, at a far more sophisticated level than we are with beer. They're changing government policy, they're changing consumer awareness. They operate a national network of volunteers that they call gleaners, and gleaners will go into farmers' fields and collect up all those fruits and vegetables that they might not otherwise sell because they're ugly or wonky, or the supermarket that's buying them has cancelled their order at the last minute. And they'll redistribute that for good reasons.
I mean, it's just great, isn't it? I've just poured the next one. I've just looked at what you've just given me. I thought it was a bottle opener. It's your business card.
Yeah.
So you have a business card, which is genius. So it says Rob Wilson, Chief Toaster, and it's like it's like a metal business card, but it's got a hole in it so that you can open beer bottles. I'm going to get some of these.
That's fantastic. Do you think we should have Food Talk branded?
I think we should.
Bottle openers.
That's brilliant.
That's a brilliant idea.
The sort of company just actually sent them to me out of the blue. It's fantastic. They sort of sent me these.
Really?
Who are they?
I don't know whether I should plug them. We'll have to swap details later on. I think they're called Merch Factory. So I haven't actually.
Merch Factory.
It's just shameless of me to plug them because I haven't actually purchased them.
Have you not?
It's a little bit excessive for us actually because we're all about sustainability.
Yeah, sustainability,
an incredibly unsustainable thing. But we make good use of them by using them as the bottle openers. There's actually we're going to be making our business cards from paper.
Bread.
You can make business cards from paper that's made from spent grain. So the grain at the end of a brew can actually be used to create paper. So we're going to have some fun with that.
A bread business card so people can eat your business card? Probably not the point of a business card, is it?
Stamp it on a slice of white. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just tasting the Session IPA. That's 4.5%.
Yep.
Like that too. Even more hoppy, I think, and even more slightly bitter, I would say.
Exactly. exactly. Yeah. So a stronger flavour. I mean, obviously, in terms of, we were just speaking earlier about sort of food pairings and things, but I think this one lends itself quite well to a curry or something like that. So quite a strong flavour. It will balance out. And we wanted something, you know, really flavoursome, really delicious, but a lower ABV. So this one's 4.5%. It is more sessionable.
Sessionable.
You may be able to drink
one. Is that a verb?
You may be. Yeah. Now it is. No. You may be able to drink one or two. First. We emphasise that bread shouldn't be wasted, and neither should you. So drink responsibly. We don't want.
Oh, he's very good, isn't he? So, oh, he's good. I want to meet your copywriter.
We don't want. We don't want anyone drinking too many of them. But we know that people do like more than one, and so. We hope that the Session IPA makes that a bit more accessible.
You've also got something else on your website that says, if you want to save the planet, then you need to have a better party than those ruining it.
Yeah, so this is our, well, so this is our mission statement. Yeah, so it's absolutely integral to who we are as a business. And we believe that to get a good party started, you need great tasting beer. Everything that we're trying to do is incredibly important. It's a very serious issue, but we're trying to approach this issue in a very fun and accessible way. We don't want to be pointing fingers. We want this to be an accessible solution that everybody can be a part of if they enjoy a beer.
You don't want to be preachy, do you? Because I do think that puts people off. Personally, I think that's what's happened with the election.
Yeah.
A little political.
Yeah, political.
No, but I do, Guy, because I think people are saying you must vote like this, and do you know, people are sick of being told what to do.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't think you should be preachy. I think you should lay out what you're doing. And if people want to choose to join that, then as long as they've got all the information, then they can.
I think that's definitely the modern approach. People seem to be much more. They align themselves with their values, whether they're kind of aware of it or not. They seem to seek out these things that they believe in and that they agree with. And I think that's fantastic that there's so much more individualism these days.
And I've got a great sort of halo above me at the moment because I'm feeling very righteous as I tuck into the next beer. Would you like to tell me what this is, Rob?
So yeah, this one's actually our summer edition craft lager. So we've made quite a sweet summer lager. Which is, at the risk of being a little bit sexist, it is
that
going
is
down incredibly well with the ladies.
This is a girly beer. I like this a lot.
And we've actually converted quite a few people to drink beer with this.
I have to say, I'm not usually a lager drinker, but this is quite nice.
It's not lager. It doesn't feel like lager to me. Mm. I don't like lager.
So we call it top lager actually because it's almost reminiscent of a lager top.
No, it's not wrong.
but it is nice and sweet, and it's very kind of delicate compared to some of it. It has
got a bit of bitterness, though. I don't like really, really sweet things.
Yeah, of course. So it's still packed full of hops, and it's a craft lager. But again, we wanted to make something that was very accessible. So we've got another lager as well, actually, that I haven't got with me, that is more of a traditional flavoursome lager packed full of hops.
I believe that you two went out drinking. I've been told the other day,
it's vicious rumours
that you were trying. You didn't invite me. I noticed that. You said
spare
there was
the moment thing.
A lovely one that you tasted in particular that you were very keen.
Yeah,
on.
So I was very honoured. Rob and the team at Toast invited me and some of our team down to the Temple Brewhouse in where would you say Oldwich?
So it's on Essex Street, near the Strand.
Yeah, the Essex Street Brewery, where I believe you've brewed some of these like limited edition collab type beers before, and you had a new one that you did as part of the crowdfunding series, which I believe is the thing that has resulted in these two of the three that we're tasting here today.
Yep.
And they brewed this fantastic Weiss beer with waste orange peel in it, and it was really spicy it was absolutely fantastic, and we had a couple on I can't even remember what day it was. Tuesday night, I think it was.
Yeah, I think we did have more than one or two. So spiced Weiss, really delicious beer.
I'm really keen to try that. I'm so upset you haven't bought it with you.
No, I know. So this one's only available on tap actually at the Temple Brewhouse. So you need to get yourselves down there
to highly recommend it.
To give that one a try. And so we actually partnered up with at Camden Market, we've got a brilliant bakery there called the Flower Station, where they give us some of their bread that they haven't sold at the end of a day. They've got some delicious sourdough that, for some crazy reason, they haven't managed to sell, and we managed to put that into our beer, and there's a local juicer in the market that gave us all of his oranges after a day so that we could use the peel. So we were putting all of the peel into it, put some spices in there. It's a fantastic
there was
spiced vice.
There was basil in the bread as well, wasn't there? We were trying to work out what the kind of green herby bit was.
Yeah, there was. So some of the bread we actually got hold of was herbed, which we wouldn't normally put into our beer. So certainly with the beer that we bottle for our main recipe, it is fairly sort of run of the mill bread. We don't want any strong flavors in that bread because that will really come through. But Vanessa, the brewer that was making the spice vice, was really keen to just get that bread in there and see how that.
It's a brilliant experiment.
Now, Guy, the thing for you is, I know on the Food Rush you've been researching and have got quite a lot to say about what we call food rescue, and I think this has been called food rescue, food waste,
surplus. There's all sorts of different ways of talking about it, and it kind of comes into different shapes and sizes. It's something that we've talked about quite a bit over the last 18 months, 2 years or so. We're actually going to be relaunching the Food Rush with a slightly different twist to it next month in July. And we're actually doing a small campaign with Toast Ale to try and bolster this discussion about the food waste issue, the scale of it, you know, the fact that we throw away a third of the food that we produce in this country. And like you said earlier, 44% of the bread that is baked never gets eaten. It's just kind of crazy.
But what I'm really liking, though, is it's almost like Ready, Steady, Cook, where somebody's saying, well, I've got some orange in Camden Market. I've got some bread with some basil in it. I've got this, that and the other. And really trying to work out what you can do with that. And isn't that great? We've had a
bit of fun with it because kind of previously we were trying to, you know, do lots of articles which talked about these issues, but trying to do it in an approachable way. And whilst that was good and we got some good response to it, we just tried to make it a little bit more fun and accessible and you know, for a slightly more consumer-friendly audience. So we've been putting together a whole load of food waste recipes and looking at ways that you can, you know, turn random things that you've got in your fridge into something tasty and delicious. Mm. We even had one of our writers went to a local bakery and said, have you got any leftover bread? Because I'm writing this piece for this food website and, you know, we want to make some recipes. And they were like, yeah, absolutely. So they handed over this huge pile of random assortments of bread related things, and she's put together something like five or six different, you know, tips for reusing bread at home, whether it's, you know, whether you get it from the local bakery or whether it's just kind of sitting there going stale on the side.
What I really like about this, it's very community orientated.
Absolutely,
and very local. And I think what we're seeing as well is on this program, we're getting quite a lot of people here who are trying to work out how locally they can make that happen, especially when some people are really struggling to afford food and you've got food banks and you're thinking, well, why have I got a food bank over there when we've got all this food waste over here?
Well, that was on a slightly tangential but related topic. That was something that I was seeing after the big acquisition of Whole Foods by Amazon.
Not sure what I feel about that, actually.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff, you know, happening in the media about it, but one thing that I read stood out, which was quite interesting. I don't have all the details in front of me, but someone was saying this is a huge opportunity for ending food deserts, which are these kind of places in and around cities or urban areas where there's just not masses of access to food, and people are, you know, they don't have a local supermarket that is easy to get to, or they don't have a, you know, a grocery store or a butcher or any access to anything that's unprocessed. So
in terms of you can't walk to somewhere.
It's very, very challenging to get food that you need, and perhaps these are, you know, slightly poorer areas where, you know, even the idea of, you know, getting it delivered is challenging. So so they're really. Is a bit of a call at the moment to, you know, hope that Amazon can come in and solve this problem with the kind of quality food and the sustainable produce and all of that kind of good for you, good for the planet type stuff that you see at Whole Foods.
Because the problem is when you live in a community that's not particularly well connected, you know, by transport and all sorts of other things, food is really expensive because, you know, you've got a local shop and it's expensive for them.
Well, it's expensive anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, you're not having access to a, you know, farmer's market or somebody who's doing, you know, really decent local food.
It's really crazy, and I think there's so much confusion and so much lack of understanding about what really goes into producing any kind of food. I mean, Rob was just talking about the sourdough that you picked up for this kind of collaboration brew. And sourdough, we make it at home, and it's this incredibly labor-intensive process when you use the artisan bread-making techniques. And the idea of throwing away even just like the tiny little slice on the end is like sacrilege, because you've put your literal like blood, sweat, and tears and effort into it. Mm. And it's crazy that we, you know, not only are we wasting so much food, but we're, you know, we're wasting all the resources and the people's time and and all that kind
that
of stuff.
Goes with
so
it.
It's something we're really passionate about.
Rob, are you finding that because of the story and because you are putting things back into society in the way that's working, that it's helping your brand and attracting, you know, a particular sort of consumer who's trying to search out those things? And we are probably talking about people a bit more privileged and maybe more sort of city-centric, possibly. But given that, are you finding there's a sort of a type of consumer who are really attracted to your sort of story?
So yes and no. So one of the really important things for our product is that we are price competitive, and not falling into a category where we are only accessible to the privileged few. So we are very much, you know, in the craft beer category, which is a more expensive category than some of the big global brands. But we're certainly price competitive within that category. We do have a lot of our customers come to us because they are really interested in that story and that authenticity. But it's incredibly important to us that we reach an audience of all craft beer drinkers, rather
who just
than
like
your
the taste.
Yeah, rather than your sort of stereotypical ethical consumer. Because, you know, bread waste is a huge issue. Food waste is one of the biggest issues of our time. It's one of the largest contributors towards greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. The food industry is by far and away the biggest contributor towards greenhouse gas emissions. And when a third is going to waste, it really is just crazy, that inefficiency. And so, you know, our solution is only a small part of the very complex puzzle. But it's very important that it's not just a sort of a small portion of people that are buying social, but that anyone can consume these sorts of products.
Well, I'm right up for the crafty lager. And actually, I might take that home if that's all right.
Absolutely.
It's very, very good. So moving on from toast, let's talk about you. Is that all right?
Of course.
I was going to put you on the spot. So you've got a really interesting background, actually. You say you're a chief toaster at Toast Ale, but actually you've got a degree in politics. don't know why you did that. You're obviously involved with quite a lot of charities, and particularly in Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about why that's important to you?
Yeah, of course. So straight at university, a friend of mine was teaching in Tanzania, I had studied politics, thought I was going to go and get a proper job somewhere. Probably not use that politics.
Is a proper job?
No.
Would you like to explain that?
Certainly,
Rob?
Wasn't going to use the politics, but I was going to hopefully get myself a proper job. And then my friend sort of persuaded me to come out to Tanzania to see some of the work he was doing. It just became incredibly apparent that there was such need for support. And I was a very keen, active student volunteer when I was at university. And so we ended up starting an organization called Read International, where we created a network of student volunteers within Tanzania. So these are Tanzanian student volunteers who have the same sort of holidays as UK students. We're very keen to volunteer in their summer holidays.
In their own community.
In their own community, rather than setting up an international volunteer program.
Do you know what? You're so right. I mean, it just feels like, God, I'm going to get slated for this, but it does feel like, you know, sort of middle class children who go and do their little stint abroad, which is incredibly helpful. But what you really want to do is train local people, if you can, to help their own community, don't you?
Exactly. And that's certainly what I felt very guilty of myself. And so quickly realised that there was an alternative here. And so creating this national network of student volunteers within Tanzania who go into their local community. Often they're living in some of the cities now, but they have parents or grandparents who were living in far more rural areas who tell them that life was very, very different just 20, 30 years ago. And so it gives them a very interesting opportunity in the same way as it would for a British student to go to a rural community in Africa.
Yeah, I think a British student, you know, the great value you can add is by teaching other people skills that they can then use when you've left.
Exactly. And many of the people living in urban centres in Tanzania have exactly the same skills to teach and bring with them. We've created over 100 libraries within Tanzania, provided over 1 million books to school children in Tanzania. And that's all now entirely led by a team, Tanzanian based, and I still interfere now and again, but I'm not involved on a day to day basis. And then my wife and I actually got married and took a mega moon traveling from Cape Town to Cairo to write a book about change makers in Africa and really inspiring entrepreneurs who had started up socially conscious businesses or charities. And through that journey discovered an organization called Ashoka, and Ashoka supports social entrepreneurs all around the world, which is where Tristram and I were then connected, and Toast Beer was born.
I mean, in Africa, in some of those countries and in some of those poor areas, especially sort of sub-Saharan Africa, I would say, they would be astounded at the fact that with the food waste that we have. You know, it's a real first world problem.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? It's terrible.
Well, so interestingly, it isn't just a first world problem at all. So that's something that is a misconception.
Right.
And one thing I should absolutely emphasise as well, actually, is that even charities feeding the homeless in the UK are turning bread away because there is so much of it. Mm. And charities feeding the hungry are... you know, absolutely turning food away often. There's some food that they absolutely need, but some food that they are turning away because there's just so much of it. So a lot of social enterprises and businesses that are making good use of food waste is you know, perfectly appropriate. Mm. Please don't think that there are people going hungry because of any of this. We're about to expand to South Africa, and we're going to be brewing in Cape Town. And in South Africa, there is a huge amount of food waste as well. A huge amount of the bread is wasted. We think it's just under 40% rather than 44%, but it's still a massive waste.
Is that just in the city areas?
Yeah, so bread is an incredibly cheap product to make. There's retail, you know, all over Africa now. I think the sort of maybe stereotypical misconception about Africa is some of what you may see on Comic Relief, but the vast majority of populations are living in urban centres surrounded by shopping malls and supermarkets and have access to retail. And those retail institutions in Africa are as guilty of food waste as ours are in the UK and in London.
I mean, Cape Town for me is one of the greatest cities in the world. I really like Cape Town a lot.
Fantastic food and drink as well.
Absolutely,
it's some of the best seafood, some of the best meat as well. You don't often get the best seafood and the best meat
and
in one place.
And the wine as well.
And the wine! Oh, God, Stellenbosch. So they've got all those combinations, and they drive on the right side of the road. I mean, you can't get better than that. but what will they make of Toast Ale there, do you think?
Well, so far, so good. So the beer will be hitting the shelves in the next couple of months. We've partnered with a local social entrepreneur there. We're working with a brewery in Stellenbosch.
And did you have to go out and check it out?
I sadly haven't yet, but that's the master plan. You know,
absolutely.
Every other
great
week.
Plan.
And you know, obviously, one thing we were very conscious of was the communications around food waste in a market that there might be more sensitivities. But you know, the realities are the realities. There is still a huge amount of food waste, and we need to increase that awareness. Of course, we want to support local initiatives as well that will be redistributing food to those that need it. And more needs to be done there for sure.
Yeah, as far as the company's concerned, then the sort of UK operation will channel its money into the UK. But if you're going abroad, and I know you want to go into America too, you'll sort of ring fence that money back into campaigning there.
Exactly, a little bit of both, because Feedback is a global organisation running global campaigns. And so we're very keen to support a lot of their global work. We're also keen to support local initiatives all around the world. And our ambitions are truly global. And like you said, we're about to hit the shelves in New York for July 1st, ready for July 4th celebrations in the US, starting in New York, but very much hoping to grow nationally as quickly as possible. And we're brewing in Cape Town and Reykjavik in Iceland as well.
Reykjavik.
Yeah, it's a random place to have...
bread doesn't go off there, does it? It just freezes.
Yeah, just leave it outside.
Just use one slice at a time outside your igloo or whatever it is.
I think it might be getting slightly confused there. I think the toast has gone to your head.
Not got that right, have I?
No.
No. we're coming to an end of the programme now, and it's really great to speak to you. Where will it go, though, as an organisation that's a social, you know, a social enterprise?
Yeah, so...
difficult to plan that, isn't it?
Well, it is very difficult to plan, and it changes on an almost daily basis at the moment as things do at this stage of our business. We've only been going 18 months and we're incredibly ambitious. We want to solve what we see as a truly global problem. And the only way that we will really achieve that is for other brewers to come on board. We want to collaborate with breweries all over the world. We want to expand our own operations, and we hope we can open up the eyes to other much larger brewers that if they were just to replace a few percentage of the grain bill with perfectly good fresh bread, we're not talking about moldy bread, we're talking about perfectly good day fresh bread, which is going to waste by the ton in every single village, town and city in the world, and we can solve that by brewing it up into beer.
So I guess you're trying to put yourself out of business, is what you're saying.
In a way.
Well, in a way, yes. Yeah. You know, the day that there's no more bread going to waste to be brewed is the day that we can shut up shop and say mission accomplished, and we would be very happy on that day.
Absolutely. Fantastic stuff.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I'd like to thank Jacob and Sam, obviously, from Tiggs. And you've got to taste Toast Ale if you haven't tasted it before. And let's face it, it's a really good sort of enterprise.
It's an award-winning beer as well.
It is an award-winning beer. you've been listening to this Food Talk show with me, Sue Nelson, and my co-presenter, Guy Routledge of Food Rush. Don't forget to tweet us if you have any comments or you want to suggest a guest for the show.
Yeah, why not?
We'd be happy to that. And that's at Food Talk Show. Meanwhile, catch our show on a huge range of local radio stations. We're now stretching from California to Kent and Malta to Michigan. We're being broadcast everywhere at the moment.
Very good.
Or, of course, you can download one of our hundreds of podcasts at www.foodtalk.co.uk or via iTunes, Podbean or the podcast app. So I look forward to you joining me next week. Thanks again, Rob, for joining us. And make sure you taste some Toast Ale. Thanks for bringing the beer. See you next week.